I was adopted into my family at 6 months. And they actually got me at 6 weeks and then officially adopted 6 months. And I was adopted into the most wonderful family that you can imagine. And thank God I was, because we went through a lot together. Had a wonderful mother who's still with me. And actually, I live with her. She's going to be 79. She doesn't mind telling her age. And my father passed away in 2011, but I had a great dad too. And I have an older brother who's 7 years older than me.
Did you know anything about your biological family coming up, or?
No, and it's funny because after I was diagnosed at the age of 19, we went back through the courts and tried to get the records that we could. And we got 3 pages of information that were, very little. I know that the biological mother was going to the University of Florida at the time. She was 19. She came up to Cleveland to have me. There was no health history. There was no history about a father. There was some limited information. As far as I know, I have a lot of Cherokee Indian in me, but that's about it. That's about all I know.
Well, you say you were diagnosed when you were 19.
Yes.
What happened? What started to evolve?
There were things going on since I was a kid, and actually, my parents had taken me to a psychologist early on when I was in grade school because of my horrific nightmares. I had never been traumatized. I had a wonderful family. There was no reason that I was waking up screaming 3 times a week. But the psychologist just said, don't feed her before bed. And this, I'm 45 years old, so this is back, in the day. And that was all that ever happened with that. So I just lived with those nightmares for, up until a few years ago, actually.
Well, not to put you back in a space of nightmares, but we all have nightmares. What was it that was different and compelling? Was it just the frequency of it, or?
Frequency, and they were always, it's funny, they changed as I grew. When I was little, it was always about somebody chasing me, somebody trying to kill me. As I grew up and got older and was bullied in school, in junior high, when I was very awkward, I became the aggressor in my nightmares. And I think, looking back on that, I think that was where the mental illness really started to evolve too. Because as I became a teenager and into my late teens, is where I really became very depressed or very manic. And I remember in ninth grade, that was the first time I wanted to take my life. So yeah, I can see how it's evolved. And then when I went off to college when I was 17 and went to the University of Cincinnati for aerospace engineering. And 2 years into that, well, really, the first year that I got down there, I did okay for about half the year. And then I came home for the summer, had a job. Things were okay. I went back for my second year, and that second year was not good. I really was having deep, deep depression and not going to class or sleeping through class or just avoiding life in general. Or I was so manic that I was trying to do 18 things at once. I was sitting on a lot of different panels at school, in a sorority, on Greek Council, on Student Alumni Council. I was just trying to do everything all at once. And then I would crash, and then I couldn't do anything. And it became, and I didn't understand
That's what
why.
I was going to ask. Well, as you're thinking this through, what were you, did you say something's wrong here, or did you just figure this is just the system?
I thought it was somewhat normal. I thought everybody experienced that to some degree. And then when my thinking started to, I don't know how to explain it. My thinking got to a point where it was psychotic in nature. I was going through a psychotic episode because my mania was so high. I was very angry, very acting out, and things like that. And I knew then that that probably was not normal, but but I didn't know that there was a name for it. I didn't know that that was a common symptom because nobody talked about bipolar back in 1992.
That's what I was going to say.
Nobody talked about it back then. So the second summer when I came home, my mother's, I didn't share a lot about what was going on because I thought it was kind of normal. So I did share with my mother that I wanted to take my life. And so she got me into a psychiatrist. The following week, we were able to get in. He met with me for 45 minutes, asked me all the normal questions, you know, that they test you for. And then at the end of 45 minutes, he looked at me and he said, "Do you even realize your mind doesn't work like a normal mind?" And I was like, "What?" I said, "No, I said, I'm just really intelligent. And you don't understand me." And he said, "No, Diane, you really have a serious issue going on here." And I was in disbelief. And really, I went through disbelief for a long time.
Well, okay, you say it was disbelief. Mm-hmm. Were you also angry that he suggested that?
I was very angry, yes. Yeah, and I thought he was an idiot somewhat, you know, because when you're 19, you think you know it all.
Well, you think everything.
You think you know better than all the doctors and everybody else. So what happened was he called my mother into the room. And he convinced, then he wanted to talk to my mother alone. And in that room, I found out years later, he convinced her to get me over to the hospital.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she...
Just to be sure I understand, even back then, it was you were a danger to yourself or others.
Yes.
The condition for mm-hmm. involuntary commitment.
Well, it wasn't involuntary. That's the thing. He tried to, you know, he told my mother what to say and what to do to get me over there. And so when my mother came out of the room, she was crying. She was so upset. And she said, "Well," she said, "the doctor wants us to just go over and see what the hospital looks like." And I'm like, "Why?" And she said, "Well, we're going to go up to this, you know," I forget what floor it was, fifth floor or whatever. And she said, "We're just going to go and take a tour so that if you ever need, you know, to be in a safe place, you know where you're going." So I got up there.
Which hospital was this? Mercy or?
It was Mercy at that time. They no longer have a psychiatric unit. Okay. And this was like a long time ago. Yeah. So we got up there and then it was, "I'm sorry, but you're not going home." And it was after my little tour, and I had remembered that when they showed me you could not go into this certain section of the hospital that was considered lockdown section, but there was a little window in the door. And I remember there was a man banging on the door, looking through that window, trying to get my attention. And I remembered how sad that was. And I said, is that what you do with people here?" And she said, "No, you'll never have to worry about going back there." And I said, "Well, okay." And so then they told me I was going to stay. And I broke down and I was very angry. And they put me back in a private room way at the end of the hall. And my mother went home to get my things. And the entire time she was gone, because we live about a half hour away, so she was gone about an hour, I stared at the shoes I had on. I laid on the bed and just kept staring at the shoes that I had on. I can still remember the exact same patent leather pair of shoes that I had on that day. Because my head was just reeling. Like, what in the world is going on? I cannot believe I'm in a hospital and somebody's telling me there's something wrong with my brain. Yeah. Yeah.
So she came back and...
She came back with my father and, you know, they got me settled in and I was not happy about that, very mad at them. But at that time, I don't know if they had HIPAA laws back then or not, because I don't remember ever signing a paper saying they could or could not.
Yeah,
could or could not have. Yeah, I think they were told everything that was going on, even though I was 19. And because I was not happy with him. I mean, today in today's world, I probably would not have signed a consent for them to see me. So went through the first 3 days. They had diagnosed me with depression only.
Not bipolar.
Not bipolar. No, they never used that word until 3 days later. For 3 days, I was diagnosed with depression, and they had put me on a pretty high dose of antidepressants right out the get-go.
What was the dosage, or what was the medication?
You know what? I don't even remember at this point. I don't know if it was Prozac. There weren't a whole lot to choose from back then.
Right.
Whatever it was too high of a dose, and it was the first time I had ever taken medicine, other than aspirin or something like that. And I had never taken anything for my brain before. And also, when you are bipolar, you're supposed to be on a mood stabilizer rather than, some people are on a mood stabilizer and an antidepressant. But when you're simply on an antidepressant, what happens? You go manic. I went highly manic. It was probably the most extreme episode I've ever had, to the point where I was having hallucinations. I thought that Satan was in the room with me, and I tore up my room, and I remember taking cassette tape, and I had so much aggression that I broke the tape right in half, and I started trying to slip my wrists with this tape. And I had never done anything like that before. I mean, this medication just had me off the wall. And I went running out of the room, and I was trying to hide under chairs in the common area and different things like that. And the nurse came out, and she's like, "What is going on?" And I said, "Well, I'm very scared. I just want to stay out here right now." And she thought I was just scared because I was in a private room at the end of the hall. So later on, early that morning, this was at night. Now, early that morning, I'd stayed out there and stared at that door like the whole night, because I was scared to death. And my wrists were also scabbed over by this time.
You had taken the cassette.
Right. It was summertime, but I put a long sweatshirt on over top of my wrists so they couldn't see what I had done. And so earlier that morning, the nurse went down to my room and saw that my room had been torn apart. And she came up and she yelled at me and she said, "You need to get back in that room and make your bed, put the mattress back on and get that room straightened up." And I said, "I'm not going back into that room." And she said, "Yes, you are." And I said, "Satan is in that room. I'm not going back in." And so pretty soon here comes the doctor. And the doctor came out and I was talking to him and I was kind of flailing my arms and telling him how scared I was. And he could see the bloodstains through my sweatshirt. And he pulled up my sweatshirt and saw my wrist. And he's like, "What did you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm very scared. I just wanted to die." And so he just got up and walked away. All of a sudden, I see two large men come out and they said, "Will you come with us?" And I said, "No, you're not going to take me back to my room." They said, "You're not going back to your room." And I said, "Well, I'm not going anywhere with you." So I was literally dragged by my wrists back to the lockdown section that I was told I would never have to worry about.
The one with the mirror.
The one with the man who was tapping on the door. Yes. I was very angry, and I was kicking, and I was screaming. I thought I was going to die. I didn't know what was going to happen to me, and, So they got me back there, and they put me in 5-point straps, which means both feet, both wrists, and your forehead were strapped to the bed. So that was before breakfast. So I never ate breakfast. And there was no clock in the room. Nothing was in the room except for the bed I was on and then a camera up in the corner that I kept staring at. And I don't know how many hours I was there. I know after the fact that my mother had come to the hospital at lunchtime to bring me, I don't know, some sort of item. And she went into my room and somebody else's belongings were in there. They had already moved somebody else into that room. So that's how much time had passed. So she went up to the desk. She's like, "Where is my daughter? I cannot find my daughter." And they said, "Well, she's in the back." My mother goes, "The back? What's the back?" And she went running. You had to go through the nurse's station into the other back part of the nurse's station. She went running back there and she saw me on closed circuit TV, strapped to the bed. I had, you know, soiled my pants and everything. I was just, you know, I was screaming, but you couldn't hear anything. I don't know if the room was soundproof, or I remember the door was very heavy when it shut. So she's like, get my daughter out of that bed. And I don't know what happened. You know, she hasn't ever, we try not to talk about it. We try not to go back there too much. But I remember there was this wonderful nurse. Her name was Jennifer. And she was the one who opened that door finally. So I don't know how many hours I was laid there. But she opened the door. And she said, "Honey, are you all right?" And I said, "No." And I could barely speak by that time because I'd been screaming all day. So I didn't have much of a voice left. And like I said, I had soiled myself and, you know, my muscles were all rigid from fighting against the straps, trying to get myself loose. And so my forehead was pretty scraped up. So were my wrists. So were my ankles. But she got me up. There was nobody else in the room, just her and I. And she got me up out of that bed. And which, you know, wouldn't happen nowadays. Nowadays, they have a whole team come in, you know, but she got me up out of that bed and she helped me sit up and she said, "Do you want to take a shower?" And I said, "Yes." And she walked me, she got somebody else, and together they walked me over to the shower. Now you could not, there was no shower curtain. You had to stand there and the person outside of the shower had to turn the water on and off and adjust the temperature so you didn't scald yourself. So I did not have control over the temperature, and I had to be, you know, naked in front of the two nurses that were there, which was very difficult. But I was just happy to wash everything off of me. And
were they continuing the medication through that time you were in there?
I was so out of it for so many days after that. I don't know what they adjusted at that time. I know that at that point the word bipolar was used, and I had no idea what it meant. But at that point, they started saying bipolar. And so that was my third day in the hospital. That was my first experience ever being in a hospital, and very traumatic to go from 4 days earlier. I didn't know that my brain was any different from anybody else, and just the whole shock of the entire thing. And I don't know, I still think about that sometimes, but for a long time I couldn't lay in that position. Even if I wasn't strapped down or anything, right. I could not, because it triggered that memory.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that would be a pretty intense.
Oh, absolutely. Memory. Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you were released at the end of 3 days?
No.
Or, okay.
Oh, no. I was there 3 weeks.
Oh, 3 weeks.
I was there 3 weeks, yeah. They had to get me stabilized. And then I was brought from, eventually I was brought from the lockdown section back out to the normal section. And actually, that first hospital stay was really where I started to smoke. Because back in 1992, you still smoked in the psych wards.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was really, there wasn't too much to do back then. So we sat around on the leather couches. They made sure they were leather so we didn't burn them up. Of course, they had burn holes everywhere from people being on, you know, heavily medicated smoking. And there was a pool table, and they had games, and it was just sort of a party up there. And I ended up, I think my parents were bringing me over a carton of cigarettes every like 4 days.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's all we did.
And you had went from not smoking at all to...
I had smoked a little bit in college on and off, but never like... This is really where I became a hardcore smoker. Yeah.
What about therapy or treat? I mean, you were there for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of treatment were you getting?
Well, they did have some things going on as far as occupational therapy. They had some very good occupational therapists. And I remember that those were the only people, and Jennifer, the nurse, that I trusted. I trusted the occupational therapist, too. Remember, there was one named Bruce, and one named Sonia, and one named Bonnie. And I remember them to this day because they were nice to me when nobody else was. And so we did some art things, some things like that. Sometimes we, as the years went on, because I was hospitalized over and over again for about 2 years at the same place.
How many stays in that period of time?
Within that 2 years, I was probably in 10 times.
Wow.
Yeah. I would say at least 10 times. Yeah.
Was there a point at which this became routine for you?
Yes. Yes. And really, like I said, it was a party. I had lost all my high school friends. I had lost all my college friends. You know, nobody wanted to have anything to do with me because I was out there. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm. And, yeah, so this was a place where all of a sudden I was like, well, these people know what I'm talking about. And I get to smoke and play pool and games. And yeah, so one, I mean, I also was not doing well. I wasn't medicated correctly at all. So
what was your medication, your long-term medication?
Wow, I don't even remember. I've been on just about everything at some point in time, including going over to Canada to get drugs that were not even in the United States yet. That was later on.
But. It's interesting because yesterday I was over at NeoMed, the medical school up in mm-hmm. Queenstown, and meeting with a pharmaceutical psychiatrist, pharmacist, who is also a psychiatrist. And she was saying, absolutely, the way you start now is you keep the dosages as low as you possibly
yeah.
can.
Absolutely.
As accurate as you possibly can.
Absolutely.
So it was a whole different world.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. It was very, very different. There's still some shades of it that exists today,
yeah.
Which we have to work on. But I know nothing like that would happen in today's world.
So for 2 years, you're in and out of the hospital.
Right.
Regularly.
That specific hospital, yes.
Misdiagnosed, or not misdiagnosed, but mistreated.
But just,
not mistreated.
I wouldn't say I was always mistreated there. I think it was just that one incident where it was more like punishment than it was helping me. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was, yeah, I felt that was not because I was a danger to myself. I mean, I realized I was a danger to myself, but to leave me there for hours was more punishment than anything for messing up my room. That's how I've always felt about it. Yeah, because I, you know, but... I ended up in the lockdown section maybe two or three other times after that because I was combative and just had a lot of internal things going on in my head.
So at what point did it start to change? Or, well, it sounds like it was years.
It's funny that you say that. There's been a lot of divine guidance going on in my life. When the doctor finally called up my parents, including my brother. My brother's 7 years older than me, so he called up my parents and my brother, and they had a meeting unbeknownst to me. And the doctor told them at that time that I could control everything that was going on, and I would probably be institutionalized for the rest of my life because I just chose not to control it. Yes. So this is, and my mother said, you are no longer her doctor. We're pulling her out of here. And so my mother was a strong woman. My dad was strong too, but she just was not going to let that happen. And so she had overheard something somewhere about this Dr. Paul Markovitz. And she remembered that name, about him doing a lot of research or things like that. And she called, at back then you couldn't Google anything. There was no, you know. So she called the operator up in Cleveland. She knew he was in Beechwood somewhere. And she said, "I'm looking for a Dr. Paul Markovitz in Beechwood." And I guess there was more than one. So the operator said, "Let me try this one." And she put my mom through, and guess who picked up the phone?
The doctor?
The doctor. Yeah. He had a secretary, but he, you know, he was not so elitist that he wouldn't pick up his own phone calls. And she told him what was going on. He said, "Bring her up here today. I want to see her today." And we went, and they moved me from Timken Mercy up to Windsor. Windsor Hospital. Yeah. Back then it was separate. Now it's Windsor Laurelwood. Back then it was separate. There was just Windsor for mental health. And so that was where I met Dr. Paul Markovitz. And he did a lot of research. He also realized that there was something with my liver that made me metabolize medication different. So when he realized that, and, you know, took some blood tests and did a lot of testing on me, he realized that I had not had the right medication at any point in time.
This was after about 2 years?
This was after 2 years, yeah. And that's really not a rare occurrence for my peers. I hear a lot of stories. People have fought trying to get the right medication for 10 years. It's with medications for the brain, nobody knows what's going to happen when you take them. And everybody's brain and body is so different that you just don't know. And, you know, it takes the right cocktail for me. It takes more than one for me to feel good. So, and that's been an ongoing process throughout my entire life. Sometimes they quit working.
That's what I was going to say.
You
it's
need
not
to,
just finding the one magical combination.
Right.
It's being constantly aware of your changing body.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So I've gone through a lot of med changes over the years. I have had a lot of side effects over the years. And I've had to deal with medications stopping working. Or having insurance issues where I couldn't get the same medication anymore. That's happened a lot too, especially when I was trying to work in the private sector. I always tried to hold down to job, even though I really shouldn't have been a lot of times, but I always tried to do that because my family, I grew up with a very good work ethic.
Oh, yeah.
And, but yeah, so well, that's devastating when the medication stops working.
How do you become aware that it's not working? What are the signs?
I've dealt with this so many years that now I can realize subtle clues. Maybe I'm just sleeping too much or not just feeling kind of lethargic, or I'm getting angry on the road, or, you know, it varies depending on what's happening. My mother spots it in me before I spot it in myself, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, she does. She says she can see it in my eyes when I'm not doing well.
Hmm.
She says my face is very expressive. That's why I've never been a good liar. I can't lie to her. She always knows it. Uh-huh. So, yeah. So she always knows when it's coming on. And she will tell me. And then I call the doctor. But I didn't used to, you know.
Well, let's go back to
Dr. Okay,
Markovitz.
I'm sorry.
Who changed? No. I'm glad. I'm going to do that occasionally, mm-hmm. too. I'm going to run out of sequence. But, your experience with doctors hadn't been that great up till now.
No.
What made you decide to give this guy a shot? Besides the fact that your mother wanted you.
It was doing it for my mom. I wanted to feel good again. I hadn't felt good in 2 years. I hadn't felt good really since junior high. You know, I just wanted to feel good again. And she said that this guy was a rainmaker, and you know, he was gonna change my life, and I said, let's go do it. And
he identified that the medication wasn't working, why it wasn't working, made adjustments that way. What about talk therapy and other parts of your treatment?
He had a therapist who worked with him, and I can't remember her name, but she was very interesting. That was the first really therapy I had ever had. And she had me, she was a very good therapist in that she found a way to bond with me. She knew I loved music. She knew I loved to read. So she combined the two, and what she would do is give me audio tapes. You know, back then you had cassette tapes. So I'm dating myself. Wow, I'm so old.
When you said she couldn't look it up on the internet, I'm like,
yeah,
oh, that's right.
Yeah. So she would give me cassette tapes to take home and listen. And then she wanted feedback from me about, like, what stuck out to me, what she thought I needed to work on, what she thought I needed to work on, and, if, you know, what we could come to. And it was so interesting. I loved it. I loved it. And so she had me listening to a lot of Albert Ellis.
I don't know Albert Ellis.
Very famous psychologist who used to do I think it was in New York, where he used to do a weekly or monthly, almost like a show, where he would bring someone up out of the audience and just do therapy. Mm. And the man is just brilliant. And he was funny. And I really learned a lot. Mm. And one of his famous sayings is, I will not should on myself today. S-H-O-U-L-D.
Okay.
I will not should on myself. Don't ever tell yourself, you know, I should be doing this, I shouldn't, or you should be doing this, or you shouldn't. You know, yeah, I love that saying. I still use it today, actually, and
I'll
it's
bet.
One of the things that she taught me. So,
your medication is adjusted. You're getting regular therapy. What's the rest of your life like outside of that, or is there any outside of that?
I was still not all the way. It back then, there were a lot of limitations on the medications, and we just could not find the right cocktail for me. As good as he was with medication, he took me, you know, some of the way, but he actually had me seeing a doctor up in Canada at one time so that I could get medication from his cohort up in Canada, because that medication was not allowed here in the States yet. It had not gone through all the testing, mm-hmm. but it was supposedly a very good medication. It was working for me. But we had to drive up to Windsor, Canada every month to get it.
Wow.
Because you couldn't send it through the mail. They did stop it when we tried to get it through the mail.
Okay.
Yeah, it was stopped and we received a letter instead. So you can't take that chance when you're on psych meds. You can't go off. You get withdrawals if you go off them suddenly like that. So, yeah, and then he, after a few years, he moved out to California to do research. I've spoken with him since then, or emailed back and forth with him since then. So I gave him an update once I was doing well. And so he set me up with Dr. Joseph Calabrese, who's up at University Hospitals.
Yeah.
And he put me through all the testing. He's a bipolar expert. He put me through tons of testing. And he said, okay, yes, you're bipolar. Now, here's what we're going to do. And he enrolled me in a study called the STEP BD study.
STEP.
STEP-BD for bipolar disorder.
Okay.
It was one of the largest studies in the nation. And University Hospitals wasn't the only place. It was places all over the nation that were studying people who had bipolar disorder. They took blood. They took all the information from everything I could ever remember about myself, they took. And each month or each quarter, I had to fill out these entire workbooks saying about what's changed, what's happened this month, what hasn't happened, and any medication changes. I mean, it was just very, very thorough. And I think I was in that study for 5 years. Mm. And the doctor who worked under Dr. Calabrese that I was assigned to, he was a hoot. His name was Melvin Shelton. I'll never forget him. He was wonderful. And what he I believe he was both a PhD and an MD. So he would talk to me for an hour and then prescribe my meds, which you don't, you get 5 minutes with a doctor nowadays. But with him being able to do that, he fine-tuned everything. That was when I was able to go back to school and finish.
And that's when you went to Kent?
That was when I went to KSU and got my degree in broadcast news, graduating in December 2001. Yeah.
You mentioned something that I've run into a lot of people saying, insurance now covers the 15 minutes, not that
right.
hour long. What's that doing to treatment?
I wish that doctors had more time with their patients, but unfortunately there's such a lack of psychiatrists, it's, you know, all over the nation. It's for some reason, and I don't know, I've heard rumors that they get paid less than other doctors. I don't know. I have no idea. But it's sad that we don't have more people who want to go into psychiatry. I know it's a very difficult profession to be in, but I can't figure out why there aren't more people who choose that profession. Because I would think it would be so rewarding to see a patient turn around who previously had no hope. But there's a shortage, so they have to get as many people in to see the doctor as possible. And unfortunately, that limits it to 5 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever.
But there are other individuals that can fill in on some of that, correct? Counselors and
nurse practitioners. I see a nurse practitioner, actually, and she's wonderful. Yeah, I love her. So there's other people who supplement. But
now you mentioned, though, your last time in the hospital was 2006. So it wasn't like you reached the mountaintop and everything.
Oh, no.
All. Talk about that a little
bit. No. When I graduated from college back in 2001, I'm digressing, but I think it's important to the story. I tried to get a job everywhere, and I had a good resume tape. I got calls. I even went as far as Rockford, Illinois for a job interview, was offered a job out there producing newscasts. And I could not take any of the jobs because the health insurance was lacking. Either they didn't carry health insurance for their employees, or the health insurance just was not what I could afford, being on the meds that I was on. Because I was on a lot of newer meds, and for the first 7 years that they're out, they're very expensive until they go generic and then, you know. But... I could not afford to take a job that I had been trained to do. So I had to go back to Maslin with my tail between my legs and work for my mother, which was actually the first job I had back in high school.
What was that doing?
Being a teller.
Okay.
But I was so let down, and I was just not mentally in a good place because... I had worked so hard to get that degree. Walking across that stage was one of the proudest moments of my life. And 6 months later, I'm living paycheck to paycheck, you know? And that took its toll on me. And actually, I started to get a little psychotic again. I started to get very manic, very depressed, and then I would go from one to the other, you know, a few months here, a few months there. It finally culminated in me, to put it nicely, I really went off on somebody in the drive-up lane over the microphone while I was a teller. I was a lot of four-letter words, and I just had no restraint at that point. I was not even in my right head.
So just to be sure, I mean, a lot of people can say, absolutely, I relate. You train for something, you love something, you don't get the job.
Yeah.
Everybody goes through that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is all with an overlay of an underlying psychiatric, very serious condition.
Right. And any amount of stress can throw off the best medication. If you are so overly stressed, it can throw off. You can be on the exact cocktail for you. But if you are so overly stressed that you can't handle it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. That's why so many people with mental illness are on disability. It's not because we can't handle a job or whatever it might be. It's that some of these jobs, they stress you out so badly that the medication quits working. And they often go from job to job to job because they lose it because of outbursts or whatever it may be, or sleeping in or whatever it may be. And I've gone through that roller coaster too. So I ended up in the Cleveland Clinic over that one. They had to take me by ambulance to the Cleveland Clinic because there was a lot more involved in that, which I don't want to go into. You've heard enough horror stories. I had quite the anger streak. But yeah, so I ended up in the Cleveland Clinic and I threatened a doctor up there and I believe I hit him. And so they kept me there for a month. Yes, very debasing. I thought I was past all that. And then here it was rearing its ugly head again. And every time that I was in the hospital that I ever got combative, it was always over feeling that nobody was listening or that everybody was making decisions about me without me. That's very debasing. And I had had a problem ever since that very first day when he told me my mind wasn't good enough, you know, or at least that was my perception of the conversation. That's still something I wrestle with today. I feel like I have to prove myself mentally to people a lot of times. And that's, you know, I've worked through therapy with that. But, okay, so the story goes on. To get out of Cleveland Clinic, they made me have an appointment with a new doctor down here. With a new doctor down here and with a psychologist. The only psychologist in Stark County who would take me, because I was very combative and, you know, was Dr. Dennis Ward. I don't know if he's still working or not, but he's over on Whipple and he was wonderful. He helped me. He was so much like that first therapist. I was with him 10 years before I graduated therapy, which if you've got a good therapist, you eventually graduate. You eventually learn all you can. You're using your coping skills and you graduate. You know, okay. That's how it should work. But he had me working every day on something. Either it was a workbook or reading a book or, you know, whatever it was, or just practicing different techniques or something he had shown me. So my brain slowly changed because I was working it every single day according to what he told me to do. And I think, yes, medication took me about 70%. Dr. Ward took me about 20%. The other 10% I'm still working on and always will be. I don't know that anybody's 100%.
I was going to say.
But, yeah.
There's at least that margin.
Yeah.
In all
but of it. I think the reason I have a job today is due to Dr. Ward.
Well, how did you end up in this job then?
It's funny that you say that. The last time I was hospitalized, I was in Altman. And I was coming out of the hospital that day. And they had said to me in the hospital that I should try to follow up in some sort of, you know, group, because I had no friends. And they said, you know, why don't you follow up with, like, a support group or, you know, find friends somehow. And I saw a flyer that was in the little lobby there. And at that point in time, that was 2006, we only had one meeting once a month. And I thought, well, I'm going to go. It doesn't say support group, it says meeting. Meeting I can go to, but not a support group. And I went. And no one judged me. No one made fun of me. It was just sincere, uncritical acceptance at that meeting. I saw other peers there who were thriving in their recovery, some of who I'm still friends with today. And then there were also family members there. And they, you know, those people were just so welcoming. I had never gone into a meeting of any kind and not felt judged or like I had to prove myself or prove that my mind was up for the test or whatever it might be. The funny thing was that at that very first meeting I attended, they said that their secretary, back then they just had a working board. They didn't have any employees. So they said their secretary was leaving and going to North Carolina. So they were celebrating her last meeting. And they said, now we have nobody to do the newsletter. Well, the funny thing was, the job that I had was doing the newsletter for 5,000 people at the credit union I was employed at. So I was like, I know how to do a newsletter. And, you know, at first they were like, well, why don't you volunteer first and get your feet wet? And then they saw what I could do. And then they're like, yeah, go ahead and do the newsletter. So it's funny. Yeah. So I have been volunteering or working for NAMI in some capacity for 12 years now. Yeah.
How important was it through all of this that your mother was that steady presence, your parents, but yeah, especially your mom?
I can't even express to you how, and that's where I say this divine guidance that I started out talking about. The fact that I even ended up in the same house that I did, adopted to her, that was where I've learned all my strength from. She had hope for me when I had no hope. And there were plenty of days when I had no hope. She had strength for me when I had no strength. Matter of fact, I know that her and my father argued sometimes over me. I caused a lot of issues with family. But she stuck in there with me. And at times, everybody was telling her, you know, just let her go. Let her go. And my mother was like, no, because I know I won't get her back. And because I've attempted suicide twice as well. So she's just my rock. She still is to this day. We're in it together, man. You know, we're in it all the way. So
yeah, I've had a number of people say, you know, it's a mean disease and it does chase away so many in your support network. The disease itself mm-hmm. is just so alienating, mm-hmm. leaving people who are least equipped to deal with it by themselves, dealing right. with it. So what about the folks who don't have your mom? Who don't? What can be done?
There are plenty of folks that don't have my mom. Lots of them. Matter of fact, I worked out at Heartland for 3 years, and I would have to check and see if there were releases of information for the patients when they came in. Only about 30% had anybody that they would even recognize as someone who supported them. 30%. How sad is that? And it just makes me feel how lucky I am. For people who don't have that connection, I always tell them they can make that connection with people at NAMI because we get them. We get them. I get you. I haven't walked the exact same road as you, and you haven't walked the exact same road as me, but we've had a similar journey, and I get you from that standpoint. And I'll be there for you. You know, and that's what I believe really strongly in is, you know, you when you're feeling well, you put your hand back and you help other people up the ladder, you know, and that's what it's all about. Somebody did that for me. I had good mentors, and now I'm trying to do that for as many peers as I can in the NAMI program. So.
And again, the NAMI program, just there's peer-to-peer, mm-hmm. there's family-to-family.
Yes.
Talk about families a little bit.
I can't stress how important it can be to have that family member who just doesn't give up on you. Now, I also believe that it's a family's right to say, this is my boundary, and I'm not going to let anybody cross it anymore. Because we can be tough. We can be tough to deal with. And I recognize that. But these NAMI families have been through so much, are going through so much. And thank God they have a place like their own support groups and their own, educational courses that they can attend where they feel like they are not alone in this either. They need as much support as people with the diagnosis do. It affects the entire family. Absolutely. I wish that my mother would have known about NAMI. You know, NAMI didn't exist way back then. I think it did to some extent, but we didn't know anything about it, no. So we tried to let people know that we exist any way we can on a shoestring.